The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to another weekend bonus episode of the Tech Meme Ride Home. I'm Brian McCullough. One of my favorite newsletters. Actually, I've really got to give you all a list of all of the newsletters I subscribe to at some point if you're interested in that sort of thing. One of my favorite newsletters is The New Consumer by Dan Frommer. Dan published his own analysis this week of the Casper IPO, and I couldn't help myself. I needed to delve into the Casper financials in greater detail. But also, we talk about scandal marketing. Can brands be canceled? And our own analysis of this week's Netflix earnings. Enjoy. So, Dan, the fact that your newsletter is, you know, The New Consumer, and it's like about talking about the new ways people spend their money, the sorts of new relationships people have with brands and products. I imagine that Casper is like, it's kind of like a flagship sort of company or test case right in your wheelhouse, right?
In many ways, especially because it was one of the first big kind of flashy direct-to-consumer e-commerce brands, you know, along with, I think Warby Parker was probably the first big one, and Casper was already probably post that stage where folks were looking at Warby Parker and saying, ah, what can we do the Warby Parker for, whether it's luggage or mattresses or makeup or anything.
Right. So like
hundreds of ideas.
Away, Harry's, Everlane, blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
Yeah. And Harry's was actually started by one of the founders of Warby Parker, who saw the model work and wanted to solve some other problems with it.
So actually, you know what? I'm thinking maybe let's back up. So let's define terms. Direct to consumer or D2C is like sort of the buzzword that everybody talks about. But like you actually in your newsletter, I'm trying to pull it up real quick. Like you kind of described it like they were all supposed to cut out the dusty, useless middlemen to deliver unbelievable value. They had simple product lineups. Casper had launched with like one mattress. The idea was they're moving dollars online that were previously spent offline, right?
Yes, and Casper famously had all these ads, including a lot of podcast ads, that basically said, come on, that mattress store is gross. That sleazy salesman is getting paid on commission. They don't care about you. Here, we've designed the perfect bed for you. There's only one option. It's great. It's $500 or whatever it is, and it gets shipped to you for free. And if you don't like it, we'll take it back. And, you know, that was fresh. That was something that a lot of people hadn't heard, and they were clearly onto something.
Well, and also I think a key component of this is the idea, or at least maybe this is a key component of selling this to venture capitalists, is that you can have a direct relationship with your consumer in the sense that every product or company wants you to have a relationship with their brand, but then you have to do it via Target or Walmart or whatever. And all of these companies were all about, no, we own the customer directly. They have direct affinity with us.
Exactly. And not only do they get our email newsletters, but a lot of them actually want to tell their friends about how awesome we are because it makes them look smart too. So there was this word of mouth thing. It was kind of ideal for the early era of Instagram. And for a lot of these companies, it really blossomed.
So, okay. Casper is sort of a poster child of this whole thing. And, they filed to go public. The filing comes out. Everyone on Twitter falls all over themselves to drag it, to pick it apart. I guess we're just going to have to get into why they did that. But actually, it was funny in your newsletter. You're like, you know, there are worse possible outcomes than going public at maybe $1 billion valuation. They're still alive, right?
Yeah. And that's kind of the funny place we're in, like, you know, sitting at computers looking at IPO filings going, well, if they only hadn't spent that much money on marketing, then, you know. But, it, you know, look, like they – the numbers which we can get into, or even not. Like, here's the thing about all these filings is that treated as a document, they're a little ridiculous. Like, they're full of these crazy hyperbolic statements. We're a sleep company. We're starting the sleep economy, stuff like that. We already knew what happened to Casper. It's very easy to like open your eyes and go, oh, there's a lot of these mattress companies now. We already knew that. We knew there was a ton of competition. We knew that they were one of over 100 of these mattress in a box startups.
Can I interrupt you?
Please.
Because I've wondered the hell out of that. Why of all segments are there 100 players in mattress in a box companies?
Well, they saw that Casper had a hit right out of the gate. And it makes sense. Like, yeah, the mattress store does suck, and those things are overpriced.
But there aren't 100 Warby Parker competitors.
I don't know. I mean, probably not as many because there's the whole regulated prescription element of it. Which like was a bigger headache to solve. But mattress sales are. I mean, unless that tag on the bottom is scarier than I thought to, you and I could probably, if we wanted to, start a mattress company by next week. So, and many did. And, you know, they saw how Casper was finding customers. And I mean, I could probably name 3 or 4 of them. I definitely couldn't name 10. And I don't think most of them have anywhere near the brand equity that Casper does. But apparently that doesn't matter that much. I mean, you can at least look, like, not all of them are going public, although one of them, Purple, I guess Purple Sleep or something, did do a reverse merger with the public company and now is public. So you can see their numbers as well. But Casper figured it out until all of a sudden, which we knew, like, there were tons of competitors in the market. It was extremely expensive to acquire customers. Luckily, beds are still pricey enough that they could and have continued to focus on acquiring customers profitably. So, you know, essentially spending less money to acquire the customer than they would make in, I guess, probably gross margin on each mattress on the first mattress sale. But then the big picture was, all right, as you said, we're going to own this customer, and yeah, we're going to start with the mattress, but then we're going to sell them all this other stuff. And if you look in their filing, it's everything from the things they already offer, like pillows and bedding, to, you know, sleep technology and sleep services and all this sort of stuff. And I don't know.
I think that's why a lot of people were dragging them, because it's like they mention that stuff, but there's no actual indication. Like, it's not like, well, 2 years ago, Casper created the sleep wearable that has taken off, or that, you know, there's other of these direct to consumer people like Brooklinen that do the stuff that in theory they can go into ancillary products and things like that.
Yeah, you could make the argument that they just didn't push enough stuff out fast enough. And really, if you look at a lot of these companies, you can praise them for their minimalism, but maybe they actually move too slowly. And in Casper's case, you know, you look at the filing and I think it said something like 16% of their customers have come back and bought something else. But most of the people who bought mattresses just bought another mattress. So,
which is great. I mean, listen, people like your product, they come back for another one. It's just that how many mattresses does a household buy in its lifetime, you know?
Right. And does this message, you know, this, we're a sleep company, we're starting the sleep economy. I know you have to put that stuff in the filing, and I know that that helps raise venture capital, and it sounds good. It certainly sounds better than, yeah, we're a mattress company, unless there's some like extreme, highly patented technological thing that they're doing with mattress technology that no one else can copy, which is not the case here, then you got to move fast if you're going to be the sleep company that everybody, you know, trusts their sleep to, which they're not. So I don't know. We'll see.
Well, but see, I think that's what a lot of people react to, or maybe everybody, the climate has changed for this sort of thing. Yes, like, so I'm literally looking at the numbers here. The so-called sleep economy, as they're calling it, is a $432 billion market, they claim, but mattresses are only $81 billion of that. And so I think the thing that people are reacting to is, it's like, not lipstick on a pig is maybe too harsh, but the sort of somersaults that these companies have to do to make it sound like there's something other than, oh yeah, a mattress company.
Right. And then the key question is this a very strong public company that should be independent and has a very clear path to, you know, whether it's multiple brands under one parent company, the way a lot of these companies are setting themselves up now is these kind of DTC holding companies, or, you know, is the Casper brand so strong and already generating a profit so that they can self-fund this new phase of their growth? And the answer seems to be neither of those. So as a lot of people have pointed out, you know, either this is a head fake to get someone, presumably Target, to pony up $1 billion and take them out and make them a Target brand, or maybe just the IPO won't happen. They're low on cash. They don't know. I think it's like under $100 million in cash left. Something's going to have to happen. Clearly, they put the time and effort into this IPO document. My guess is that the founder and CEO, Philip Krim, would love to be the CEO of an independent public Casper, but certainly not the most confident I've been in an IPO filing that I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, $100 million left. They lost $67 million in the first 9 months of 2019. And then, I mean, one more thing is like, so all of the, everyone pointed out that it's something like 33 and 42% of sales like goes to marketing. In theory, they could turn that tap off, but if you do, then you have no growth. And then why would anybody buy stock in a company that suddenly their growth is like, that's not their growth is already slowing, which is not a good thing to have happen right before you IPO anyway.
Yeah. Pretty dramatically too. I believe it was something like, you know, 40% in 2018 and then 20% in the first 9 months of 2019. So, no, not ideal.
And potentially we'd be looking at a situation where going public would essentially kill the company anyway, because if they do go public and the markets turn up their nose at it, and then all of a sudden they're down at a $200 million valuation, they're going to get bought out anyway, just not at anywhere near the valuation that they would have wanted. But, all right, crazy. Double Up is an agency that helps content creators, influencers, podcasters, YouTubers, Patreon stans, literally anyone, create a business around subscription models and freemium models. Let me read you some quotes from folks who have used Double Up to create wildly successful businesses. Double Up helped us monetize The Drive and launch a profitable, fast-growing digital subscription business. That was Peter Attia, leading physician and expert in the science of longevity, host of the top health podcast, The Drive. Double Up's team were invaluable to the successful relaunch of my premium membership offering. From analytics to messaging and creative direction, their experience helped turn my viable business into one that is thriving. That was from Rhonda Patrick, PhD in biomedical science, host of the Found My Fitness podcast. Over the last year, Double Up has helped companies, influencers, and podcasters build millions of dollars of value. Build some value out of what you're passionate about today. Go to the folks at Double Up Agency. That's doubleup.agency. And when you get in touch with them, tell them Brian sent you. I'm going to a big AI startup demo day here in the city tomorrow, and I will 100% be decked out in Mack Weldon clothing. Why? Well, Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. That's their AirKnit underwear. Crazy, comfortable, but elevated sweatpants, the Ace Collection. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads, the Silver Peak Polo. That's my personal fave. And ultra-soft antimicrobial tees for when you need to stay fresh longer. Their silver crewneck t-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to macweldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code RIDE. That's MACKWELDON.com, promo code RIDE. When you go through airport security, there's one line where the TSA agent checks your ID and another line where a machine scans your bag. The same thing happens in enterprise security, but instead of passengers and luggage, it's end users and their devices. These days, most companies are pretty good at the first part of the equation where they check user identity, but user devices can roll right through authentication without getting inspected at all. In fact, 47% of companies allow unmanaged, untrusted devices to access their data. That means an employee can log in from a laptop that has its firewall turned off and hasn't been updated in 6 months, or worse, that laptop might belong to a bad actor using employee credentials. Collide finally solves the device trust problem. Collide ensures that no device can log into your Okta-protected apps unless it passes your security checks. Plus, you can use Collide on devices without MDM, like your Linux fleet, contractor devices, and every BYOD phone and laptop in your company. Visit collide.com/ride to watch a demo and see how it all works. That's KOLIDE.com/ride, collide.com/ride. Can we talk about Away real briefly? Not Away specifically, but sort of a lot of these DTC companies have had controversies lately. I don't think I ever talked about it on the show, but like Away had this controversy surrounding leaked Slack messages from the CEO. The CEO stepped down. You had Peloton with its whole ad that people thought was misogynistic and supposedly led to like a one-day drop of millions of dollars of market cap and things like that. First of all, on Away though, specifically, like you delved into the data, and while the controversy didn't help, you saw that Away's growth was already slowing much, much earlier in the year.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation, and there's probably a lot of different factors, but including potentially this desire to focus on profitable growth. I've heard several times that Away, and maybe it was in the articles around this controversy, that Away is profitable. I don't know. I haven't looked at their books, but they've always kind of suggested that they've always been profitability focused. And my guess is that the margins on a $400 suitcase are pretty good. So especially that's made out of molded plastic. So that's kind of what I dug into. And just for context, so a lot of the data I'm going to talk about is from this company that I've been working with called Earnest Research. And they're one of several companies that basically buys aggregated credit card and debit card spending data from the credit card companies and then builds a user interface around it that their clients can use to track consumer spending. You can guess who their clients are: hedge funds, venture capital funds, anyone who really would get some sort of benefit from knowing what people are spending their money on. I wish I could afford a subscription. Mm. You and I can't afford one. Mm. But anyway, so they've been very helpful, and they partner with myself and, you know, a lot of journalists and analysts to provide their data. So, you know, when the Away thing happened, I asked them, just for context, you know, how is their growth looking these days? And it's down. I mean, you know, this is one of these situations where like the company at some point is just growing so fast that of course the numbers are going to shrink. Like you can't, if you're doubling every year forever, that's pretty crazy, because then to double, you have to grow twice as much as you did the year before. So, you know, it was something like the end of 2018, they were still growing over 100% year over year. And these are on a monthly basis, so every month's a little different. But then by the middle of 2019, they had, you know, a month or so below 50%. And then starting really in the summer, it looks like it really declined, you know, went back up to 100 and then down below 50%. So it looked like growth was already starting to slow before this controversy, this kind of PR crisis that they had. And then, you know, it was one of these situations where, and, you know, feel free to read my articles on newconsumer.com or really anywhere, but it's The Verge was the first to report this. The CEO, you know, was saying some unpleasant things to the, you know, the employees of the company. It didn't look good. And there's kind of this movement right now, you know, very pro-labor movement. And so there was a lot of kind of a lot of backlash, especially on Twitter. We could have a whole side conversation about, you know, what the mood of Twitter does and does not reflect it about.
Is Twitter real life? Hashtag is Twitter real life? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and how that correlates to people's actual shopping. I will say, like, you know, in real life, and yes, I'm a part of the New York media world, and I hang out with a lot of people who work in DTC and e-commerce and media. It was definitely something we were all talking about. You know, every holiday party I went to for a couple of weeks was like, man, those Slack screenshots, huh? So I went back to Ernest in this year in January, and I said, hey, you know, does your data for the holiday season suggest that Away's controversy, you know, had a material impact on their holiday sales? Obviously, Q4 is a huge quarter for a lot of, you know, a lot of companies, especially in e-commerce, where holiday sales plus holiday travel plus all these things would add up to a big quarter. And it looked like the year-over-year for December and was already kind of below where it was last year. November was basically flat year over year, which is not good. Although the big asterisks here, Black Friday and Cyber Monday were a week later in 2019 than they were in 2018. So the months kind of shift on you, and it's really hard to make these year-over-year comparisons. Anyway, the big picture point is Away's sales, at least according to Ernest Research, did not plunge like 50% or something like that. There wasn't this massive, massive mainstream, we're not going to buy Away anymore. That just didn't happen.
Well, that's kind of what I wanted to poke at a little bit is, like, you know, we just said that one of the things that these direct-to-consumer companies sell themselves on and rely on is the brand affinity, and like, you're an aspirational brand, you want to identify with the brand or whatever. So maybe they're more sensitive than others to controversies and things like this. But at the same time, I'm just wondering, you know, in the information and news and social media metabolism that the world has right now, is it basically impossible for company or a brand to be canceled? And I'm even think all the way back to like hashtag delete Uber. Like, maybe, and I'm not suggesting conspiracy theories here, like you would gin up a controversy just to get attention, but I mean, you know, I think a lot of normal people might have heard about, you know, Away for the first time because of this controversy. Like, is it impossible, I guess, for a brand to be canceled right now?
I mean, it probably depends on what you're measuring, like sentiment, and you're totally right. Like, these brands rely on their customers not only, you know, to provide word of mouth referrals, but to almost act as a community and almost to endorse them on social media. You know, Away, Glossier, Everlane, a lot of these brands probably get like a non-trivial amount of sales through essentially free marketing through people's social media accounts. So that's definitely part of their model, and really important to their future is that they are not only loved, but, you know, beyond normal, like that people are almost freakishly, you know, fans and promoters of their brands. Probably less so for Away than like a Glossier or a Sweetgreen or something like that, but it's definitely part of it. You know, people post their luggage all the time, and that's definitely part of their model. Look, their sales did not, like I said, their sales did not crash the month of December. They did slide quite a lot the last half of the year. Their growth did specifically. They're still growing year over year, but on a much slower rate than they had the year previously. Again, according to this one data provider, which Away has not, I've offered Away the opportunity to tell me that these numbers are totally wrong, and they have not taken that opportunity when I've asked for comment. But according to this data, again, U.S. only through credit card tracking, their growth really did start to slow in the second half of the year, but they did not shrink according to this data. So it's not like their customers all ran away.
And by this point, no one even remembers the controversy anyway.
However, so Ernest also sent me something else, which is interesting. And this is kind of how I even found out about them, is that they were tracking SoulCycle attendance after the Trump fundraiser with the guy who, you know, everyone thinks owns SoulCycle and Equinox. And there remained and this was late October data, their SoulCycle attendance was still shrinking year over year versus 2018, throughout August, September, and October, even though it was growing in May and flat in June and growing a little in July. So again, one data source, but it looks as if, and then, you know, in summer months, I guess it, I'm not an expert on this company right now, but it looks as if the shrinkage was worse this time around than previously. Is that all attributable to the controversy around a Trump fundraiser? Probably not. Like, maybe a lot of people are buying Pelotons. Maybe people are running. Maybe they're bored with SoulCycle. I don't know. But it does seem like, and if you talk to someone in the world of media and related fields, if you mention Equinox or SoulCycle, you're probably still going to get an eye roll or something like that. So I think there is some lasting damage to these brands from this, especially because they rely on people to really love them. But I don't think, you know, and the Delete Uber case is a great example. Like, that's not what caused a lot of their internal problems are what caused most of their difficulties, which allowed Lyft to survive, which, you know, caused a real competition to exist in the U.S. that would not have probably otherwise existed. But
Well, and I was just going to say, like, you know, maybe you were saying not enough data, not a big enough sample size, but also it could entirely be situational specific, you know, different countries or different companies versus different news events and things like that.
I think what we can say conclusively is, like, none of these companies were ruined by one small controversy that, you know, may have lit Twitter up for a couple of days, but I'd be very surprised if any of these companies, you know, cease to exist solely because of one of these controversies.
How do you make a password that's strong enough so no one will guess it, and it's impossible for you to forget, and do it for 100 different sites, and make it so everyone in your company can do the same without ever needing to reset them? Sounds impossible unless you have 1Password. More than any other product I've ever told you about, I can vouch 1,000% for 1Password. I can't live without it. 1Password makes strong security easy for your people and gives you the visibility you need to take action when you need to. Any device, anytime, 1Password lets you securely switch between iPhone, Android, Mac, and PC with convenient features like autofill for quick sign-ins. All you have to remember is the one strong account password that protects everything else. Your logins, your credit cards, secure notes, or the office Wi-Fi password. 1Password's award-winning password manager is trusted by millions of users and over 100,000 businesses from IBM to Slack. It beat out 40 other options to become Wirecutter's top pick for password managers. Right now, my listeners get a free 2-week trial at 1Password.com/ride for your growing business. That's 2 free weeks at 1Password.com/ride. Don't let security slow your business down. Go to 1Password.com/ride. Real quick before you go, the Netflix earnings were on Tuesday, and I spoke this week about how it's seemingly Netflix all of a sudden just wants you to know about its international growth. But what I actually didn't know until I saw your chart in the newsletter this morning was the real story is that international growth has come back. I didn't know that, but it had cratered a bit recently around, I guess, the price hike. And now it's back to where it was and accelerating above that.
Yeah, and I went back and looked at that because I was a little surprised by that too. And I think if I recall that, you know, it's one of these things where like quarterly data is probably easier than monthly to digest, but it's still, you know, there's still like a day or a month or a week where, you know, something may have happened in one quarter that maybe could have happened in the next quarter or something like that. If I recall, there was a point this year where, or last year, I guess, where Netflix says, I think we actually grew a little more this quarter than we thought we would. Maybe some of those people were from, you know, would have signed up next quarter, but because there was a show that launched last quarter that was really great, they joined earlier. That's going to happen. There's lumps here and there. I mean, I see that every week in my subscription newsletter business. You know, some weeks are great, other weeks less great. And you're like, oh, well, maybe that person was going to sign up next week, but they signed up this week. I don't know. I think the broader picture is like, yeah, the U.S., they have a lot of subscribers in the U.S. It's going to be harder for them to gain new subscribers in the U.S. relative to the rest of the world where billions of people live. So, you know, clearly the story going forward for Netflix is not just a U.S. story. It's a global story. They do have competition in the U.S. It is good that they have competition in the U.S. It's good for the consumer. It's good for the media industry. It's probably good for the art of TV and cinema. But the reality is that they are now years ahead of their U.S. competitors at building global brands, and they've put a lot of money and time into that. And, you know, we see the results, and I don't think it's just this case where it's like, oh, well, they're just signing up a bunch of people in, you know, wherever. I think that is the point, that they are building this global business, that they are trying to build a global culture around streaming media, and right now they're way ahead.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because until you said it in the newsletter this morning, I mean, this is obvious to say, but I hadn't thought about it until you said it, but like, Netflix is now the incumbent. Like, the Netflix narrative all along has been like, oh, all of these legacy media companies have to quickly build some way to compete with Netflix before Netflix kills their businesses. But no, Netflix is now the incumbent, and they have to defend their moat. And right now, international is their moat, right? Because a lot of these other players won't be able to play internationally for a while, or even at all in some cases.
Yep. And it's not gonna, you know, it's clearly not going to be easy. And a lot of these, look, these, as I also said, like, these are companies that are worth tens or hundreds of billions of dollars. So they'll find the money to make an app. You know, will they figure out the formula that Netflix has in terms of creating shows and marketing them and recommending them? Maybe, like, a lot of them have been making shows a lot longer than Netflix has been in existence. But this idea of marketing to consumers and not to the person at the cable company who's in charge of their carriage agreement is different. And, you know, that's where some companies, like, I think Disney will be successful there because they've always been really good at consumer marketing. But I'm less I'm just making this up now, but I'd probably be less confident in like NBC for figuring that out. But it's so weird now. All these brands are owned by different companies. AT&T owns HBO. Like, AT&T signs up millions of customers every month for cell phone service. So I don't know. It's such a funny, weird thing that's happening right now. And yeah, Netflix is the incumbent. Like, they're the default. When you turn the TV on, like, give me something to watch. If you don't have a cable box, then you're just probably plopping on the Netflix icon and looking for something. And I think that's a powerful position to be in.
Or asking people to pay to watch something, which some of these other companies haven't, you know, had to do before.
That is true. And I'm less nervous about that. Like, people spend money on all kinds of stuff. And yeah, it's easy to say, like, that people will get subscription fatigue or whatever, but a lot of these services are still an incredible value. Like, you know, I went to a bunch of movies over the holidays, and it's like $40 every time you go to the movies now. If you can get a month of whatever service for like $8 or something, that's a great value. So I'm less concerned about that. There is still obviously some hurdles in getting people to download your app and sign in and sign up, especially if they're trying to run away from Apple's 30% cut on Apple TV or whatever it is. But I think some of them will figure it out. I think that's fine. I don't think there's any logical world in which Netflix is ever going to be just alone. I don't think this is Google search or Facebook where there is only one massive, you know, aggregator. I think that the very fragmented world of creativity and, you know, there are a lot of things at play beyond just economics that cause people to make decisions on who they work with there. So, I would be surprised if we're sitting here in 10 years and Netflix owns 90% of, you know, paid video attention in the world. I think they're what, like 15% of viewership now or something like that. Mm-hmm. I just made that up, but that sounds like something that they've said in the past. We're like, you know, we're only like 15% of
right or of times
overall TV time or something.
Well, not even TV time. They're always talking about like your leisure time. They don't care about TV time. They want all of your, you know, non-working,
that's
non-sleeping
right.
time. Yeah.
Yeah. Sleep is a competitor. So anyway, I think they're fine.
Dan, I've been talking about all of these insights and charts that have made me realize things. If other people want to get insights and charts like that, tell me how they should find out about New Consumer.
Please, yeah. NewConsumer.com. It's a biweekly. Is that right? Is biweekly twice a week or every other week?
I don't think there's a word for
it's
when
both,
it's
right?
twice a week. Is it? Yeah.
I don't know.
I've always assumed biweekly is every other week, yeah.
It's a newsletter that you get twice a week that is my analysis and commentary and reporting on how and why people spend their time and money. I write about direct-to-consumer. I write about future media. I write about design. I write about what interests me and, you know, hopefully it interests you as well. There are some free articles. They're a little hard to find. I'm going to make them easier to find, and there will be more free articles. But if you go to newconsumer.com, there's a click the join button, and you can see all the options. You can sign up for a paid membership. You can sign up for a team plan if you want to sign your whole team up, or you can just sign up for free articles now as well. And of course, I'm also on Twitter, FromDome, and I'm there every day.
Go do it. It's a good newsletter.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
You know what? Do you know that you were my first subscriber?
I do know that. I remember.
I appreciate you every day.
I remember that you emailed me directly and told me that, and I was like, "Well, hey, listen, I know, I know a good thing when I see it."
I appreciate it.